threw the entire nation into turmoil. Even in Wallace and Teachy, blacks and whites began brawling in the wake of the murder, and Wilmington was no better. The community had made some progress in race relations since the 1950s, when local leaders saw that attracting businesses to the area hinged on changing old ways. The city had long been a railroad town until the Atlantic Coastline Railroad moved its central office to Jacksonville in 1955, causing Wilmington to look around for new industry to replace the lost jobs. Companies like General Electric had asserted that they would locate their plants in Wilmington only if the city made opportunity equal. Even so, the racial atmosphere in Wilmington remained tense. The Jordans had arrived there just as the schools launched into a court-ordered desegregation plan that sparked controversy and bitterness. Headlines and emotions were dominated by the city's evolving plans for bringing blacks and whites together in schools. Because the elementary schools were the last to be integrated under the plan, Michael and others his age began school that fall in classrooms that were still divided by race. This atmosphere sizzled until it finally exploded in February 1971, when a white-owned grocery store in a predominantly black neighborhood was firebombed. 10 people, 9 black males and a white female, were later arrested in connection with the incident and received heavy prison sentences upon their conviction. Dubbed the Wilmington 10 by the news media, the group made appeals that would play in the headlines for years until the convictions were overturned by the federal courts. This climate of conflict heightened Dolores Jordan's concerns as her children adjusted to new schools in the community. The family had lived in one location briefly before moving into the Weaver Acres neighborhood on Gordon Road. They lived in one home there for a time until they moved again, within the same neighborhood, to a large, split-level, brick and clapboard house that James Jordan built in a stand of pines on a 12-acre tract of land. It was convenient to the suburban schools of New Hanover County and to downtown. The ocean was just a few miles away, and James and Dolores sometimes escaped there on quiet summer evenings. Young Michael, however, soon developed an aversion to the water. At about age 7, he was swimming with a friend in the ocean when the friend panicked and grabbed onto Michael. Michael pushed away to keep the boy from dragging him under, and the child drowned. A few years later, Michael himself got in trouble in a pool during a baseball trip, and he had to be pulled from the water. Years later, one of his college girlfriends drowned while she was home on break. "I don't mess with water," Jordan was known to say thereafter. Weaver Acres was a relatively new neighborhood, mostly black, but families of various races lived there in relative harmony. Both James and Dolores had always taught their children to be respectful of all people, instructing them that stereotypes were of little use. "You had to treat people as people, regardless of their skin color," they explained. Indeed, a white family had lived near the Jordans back on Calico Bay Road, and the kids enjoyed the company of their playmates without incident. The family's open-mindedness suggested that the Jordans were taking great pains to prepare their children for a brand new world. This attitude of tolerance proved to be a hallmark of Jordan's early years in Wilmington. By the time he reached third grade, Michael had become fast friends with David Bridgers, a white schoolmate and neighbor. The two would remain close long after one of them became world famous. They played baseball and rode bicycles together and explored the wooded areas and creek beds in and around Weaver Acres. Bridgers was the son of a taxi driver in a family that had recently moved from South Dakota. When his parents' marriage broke up, Bridger's bond with Jordan grew even closer. They shared a love of baseball with Michael's father, who welcomed David into the household. Bridgers and Jordan took turns pitching for a strong Little League team. The one who wasn't pitching took up residence in center field. "Before every pitch, I'd look at Mike in center, and he'd give me thumbs up," Bridgers once recalled. "With him on the mound, I'd do the same." One sizzling afternoon before Michael's fear of swimming took hold, they snuck into a neighbor's backyard to steal a dip in the pool while they thought the neighbors were away. The people caught the boys in the water and ordered them out, but in such a way that both kids could tell there was a racial motivation involved. "They saw Mike and threw us out," Bridger said. "The rest of the bike ride, he was very quiet. I asked him if he knew why they threw us out. He said yes. I asked if it bothered him. He said no. Then he just smiled. I'll never forget it," he said. "I got cooled off enough. How about you?" Chapter 4. The Competitor. It took the fewest of words to set him off, sometimes nothing more than the faintest trace of a smirk. He was also capable of making things up, conjuring up an affront out of thin air. That's what they would all realize afterward. He would seize on apparently meaningless cracks or gestures and plunge them deep in his heart until they glowed radioactively, the nuclear fuel rods of his great fire. Only much later would the public come to understand just how incapable he was of letting go of even the tiniest details. Many observers mistakenly thought that these affronts were laughable things of Michael's own manufacture, little devices to spur his competitive juices, and that he could jokingly toss them aside when he was done with them, after he had wrung another sweaty victory from the evening. But he could not let them go any more than he could shed his right arm. They were as organic to his being as his famous tongue. Many of the things that deeply offended Michael Jordan were hardly the stuff of stinging rebuke, except perhaps the very first one, which, as it later turned out, was the most important of all. Just go in the house with the women. Of the millions of sentences that James Jordan uttered to his youngest son, this was the one that glowed neon bright across the decades. "My father is a mechanical person," Jordan would recall later. "He always tried to save money by working on everybody's cars, and my older brothers would go out and work with him. He would tell them to hand him a 9/16 wrench, and they'd do it. I'd get out there, and he'd say, 'Give me a 9/16 wrench,' and I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. He used to get irritated with me and say, 'You don't know what the hell you're doing. Go on in there with the women.'" His father's words rang as a challenge to his adolescent masculinity. Even then, as the first hormonal surges were starting to thicken his features, he remained a cherubic figure, one that his siblings adored and his mother delighted in pulling into her embrace. But it was a disguise. His father's mean words had activated deep within him some errant strain of DNA, a mutation of competitive nature so strong as to almost seem titanium. They represented a contempt articulated almost daily in manner and attitude in the Jordan household throughout Michael's tender years. Years later, his sister Dolores recalled, "During the early days of his NBA career, he confessed that it was my father's early treatment of him and Daddy's declaration of his worthlessness that became the driving force that motivated him. Each accomplishment that he achieved was his battle cry for defeating my father's negative opinions of him." Michael himself would later reveal that as a child he was keenly aware of his father's preference for brother Larry. James Jordan had endured a similar treatment by his own father. Medward's contempt for him would become a fixture in family lore. James himself confirmed it, and that contempt is what drove him to leave Teachy to prove himself in the Air Force. Medward was proud of his son, family members said, but he never seemed to find the means to express it to him face to face. James paid him back again and again by achieving so much in a life that his father could never hope to grasp. This is what offspring of disapproving fathers often do. Without even realizing it, they lock in on an answer and deliver it over and over, confirming that they do not need to just go in the house. And they continue to confirm it, even after the father has gone to dust, as if they are unconsciously yelling across time in an argument with the old man. Around the time that he was telling Michael to take life up among the women, James Jordan put up a basketball hoop for his sons in the backyard of the family home. Up to that point, the family's athletic focus had been on James in the backyard throwing pitches to his young sons, teaching them to hit and to love baseball. They had started at ages 5 and 6 playing t-ball. At 7 and 8, the boys moved to a machine pitch league. They faced their first live pitching at 9 and 10, which was when the dichotomy emerged. Larry was all about hitting singles, while Michael would swing for the fences. It was Larry, as the older brother, who first became infatuated with basketball. Michael was already on his way to success as a little league player when the basketball court was laid out. Suddenly, things took off in another direction. Instinct had perhaps guided James, telling him that with Michael set to star in baseball, he should build the basketball hoop for Larry. The younger brother, however, was already quite taken with basketball himself. At age 9, Michael had watched intently on TV as the United States, led by a frenetic young guard named Doug Collins, battled its way to a showdown with the Russians in the 1972 Summer Olympics. When the Americans lost amidst great controversy, Michael retreated to the kitchen to tell his mother. He said, "I'm going to be in the Olympics one day, and I'm going to make sure we win," Dolores recalled later. "I smiled to myself and said, 'Honey, that takes a lot to win the gold medal.'" The plot, however, had been set in motion. From there, it was a matter of taking in all the basketball that broadcast TV had to offer, which wasn't much. In those days, before cable and the constant presence of pro basketball on television, the once and future king of hoops wasn't able to view NBA games. But the local affiliates brought him a weekly diet of Atlantic Coast Conference, ACC, contests, which allowed Michael to follow the high-flying antics of David Thompson and the North Carolina State Wolfpack against the enemy, the University of North Carolina. NBC aired national games featuring another of his favorite teams, the UCLA Bruins. Years later, former UCLA great Marcus Johnson would be puzzled to see his poster on Jordan's wall at the University of North Carolina, but it was because he had been a TV star in Jordan's adolescence. By the time Michael was 11, James Jordan had purchased the family's first basketball, and soon after he put the finishing touches on the court. The Jordan's backyard soon attracted players from around the neighborhood, but the Jordan family rules applied. Homework had to be completed before anyone took to the court, and the 8 o'clock bedtime remained strictly enforced. Still, the main event every day became Michael versus Larry in titanic games of one-on-one. Though Jordan was nearly a year younger, he already stood above his stronger, older brother. Michael was mouthier, but they both talked trash, anything to get under the other's skin. The contests quickly turned physical, then heated. When the yelling and arguments grew to a pitch, Dolores Jordan would step to the back door to enforce the peace. Some days, she had to order them into the house. Day after day after day, they went at each other, with Larry able to use his strength to dominate his younger brother, despite the height disadvantage. The constant thumpings from his shorter brother hammered at Jordan's young psyche. The pattern of defeat would stretch out for more than a year and a half. "I think Michael got so good because Larry used to beat him all the time," James Jordan would explain later. "He took it hard." "We grew up one-on-one," Larry remembered. "I always played hard," Jordan said. "My brother and I would play every day until my mother had to call us in. We never thought of brotherhood at all. Sometimes it would end in fighting." Michael was reed thin and lacked strength, but he gradually learned how to take advantage of his height. For the longest time, they became so evenly matched as to almost present mirror images of each other. "When you see me play, you see Larry play," Jordan would later explain. "I won most of the time until he started to outgrow me," said Larry. "And then that was the end of that." By the time Dick Nahar, Jordan's youth baseball coach, visited the Jordan's backyard when Michael was a young teen, the rim was already beat up and tilted to one side, damage likely wrought by Larry's dunks, a testament to the beating that Michael's own psyche had suffered at the hands of his older brother. These backyard battles would determine the nature of the two brothers' adult relationship, a closeness tempered by sibling rivalry. They also established the manner in which Michael would relate to teammates throughout his playing career. James Worthy recalled Jordan as a new freshman on the University of North Carolina basketball team, pestering him to play one-on-one. "His mission was to seek out the best player on the team, and I was that guy my junior year. He was a bully, and he bullied me." Even before that, it had become his modus operandi at Wilmington's MP Park and at the Martin Luther King Community Center in the city. "It got to the point that I had to ask him not to come over and play," recalled William Murphy, the center's director. "I didn't want him to get hurt," Murphy said. "I was afraid he would get cut off his feet. He used to be a challenge for everybody. His attacking inspired that kind of visceral response." "It was the same everywhere he went," explained George Mumford, the psychologist who worked with Jordan as a pro player. Each opponent loomed as a Larry to be conquered. Much later, the mythology of the one-on-one games would bring his brother a certain status among Michael's coterie, first in college and later in Chicago. Michael and Larry had obviously competed wildly as boys, and Larry loomed very large in his life, explained David Hart, Michael's roommate and the team manager at the University of North Carolina. Michael really loved Larry and talked about him all the time, really revered him. But if Michael had gone far beyond Larry as an athlete, he never let it affect his feeling for his brother. His emotional connection and his respect for his brother were very strong. When his brother was around, he dropped all of his mounting fame and his accomplishments and became nothing more than a loving, adoring younger brother. Later, in Chicago, Larry Jordan would join a pro basketball league that allowed no players taller than 6'4", but he soon injured his shoulder and dropped out, concerned that his family home was being exploited. "I never really felt overshadowed because I was able to see his work ethic close up," Larry said in a 2012 interview. I played sports all my life, but I wasn't as passionate about basketball as Michael was. I was more of a handyman, mechanical, like my dad. He was a stud athlete, Doug Collins, who coached Michael in Chicago, once said of Larry. I remember the first time I saw him, this rather short, incredibly muscled young man with a terrific body, about 5'7", more a football body than a basketball body. The moment I saw him, I understood where Michael's drive came from. Pop Herring coached the brothers at Laney High School in Wilmington, where Michael became a star and Larry found limited playing time. Larry, Herring once said, was so driven and so competitive an athlete that if he had been 6'2 instead of 5'7", I'm sure Michael would have been known as Larry's brother instead of Larry always being known as Michael's brother. Perhaps some of this praise is overstated, due in part to the warmth that family and friends felt for Larry Jordan. They often described him as genuine, low-key, gentlemanly, but something of a painful lesson in fate. He was so close to his brother in ability as an adolescent, but lived eternally in Michael's shadow. It was a circumstance that would trouble Dolores Jordan over the years. It would intrude on even the fun moments between the brothers as adults. After Michael became a star in the NBA, they reprised their old one-on-one matchup one day, during which Michael paused, looked down at Larry's feet, and said, "Just remember whose name is on your shoes." Bill Billingsley recalls the two brothers taking their first steps together in organized basketball. It was in early 1975 in the ancient gym at Wilmington's old Chestnut Street School, where the city held a youth basketball league. Billingsley, 24 at the time, was coaching against the team the Jordans played on. "If you saw them, you'd think Larry was the younger one," he said. "Michael was so much taller." Even then, Larry was not the player Michael was, and by a long shot. Larry recalled that it was actually their youth baseball coach who had gotten them involved in basketball. Dick Nair was helping to form a youth hoops team and phoned Ned Parrish, who had coached Michael in youth baseball. Parrish had immediately suggested the Jordan boys. In a 2012 interview, Nair laughed at the memory of the younger Jordan on that basketball team. "He was a big-time gunner," the coach recalled. "He had never played organized ball. His Little League baseball coach had put him on the team. He was a good dribbler. He could handle the ball. He was quick. But if you gave him the ball, you'd never see it again. It was going up to the hoop. We laughed about it." Billingsley's team played three games against those first basketball Jordanaires and won two of them, mostly because Billingsley's team played man-to-man, while the rest of the teams in the league played the stiff and lazy zone defenses typical of youth basketball. Billingsley assigned his star player, Reggie Williams, who later played some college ball, to guard Jordan. Michael was their best player. To show you how smart he was, even at that age, he posted up Reggie and hit a short jump shot in the lane, the coach recalled. Even at 12 years old, he already had real basketball skills and smarts. Billingsley believed that such a move was instinctive, that no youth coach could have had the time or inclination to teach something like that. "When I was 12 years old, my brother Larry and I were the starting backcourt in Pee Wee League," Jordan remembered of the experience. "He was the defensive guy and I was the scorer. So I hit the winning basket, and as we were riding home, my father said, 'Larry, that was great defense you played.' I'm saying, 'Damn, I stole the ball and scored the winning layup.' In my mind, I'm thinking that evidently my father didn't see what I did, so I had to show him. It's funny how you look at those situations and all the steps that led to your competitive attitude." In baseball, it had been the same, he recalled. He would go for a home run, Larry would aim for a base hit, and his father would always say, "Larry, that's a great attitude to have, going for the base hit." This first recreation league basketball experience came in an era before AAU, Amateur Athletic Union basketball, brought in players at a younger age. At the same time, baseball, a game played predominantly by whites, had more sophisticated support in Wilmington, Billingsley explained. The resources for youth basketball were scarce by comparison. At the end of the season, Michael was named to the All-Star team, even though he was one of the youngest players in the league. Because Billingsley's team had won the league, he was named the All-Star coach. He began preparing the group for a statewide tournament and encountered James and Dolores Jordan for the first time. "His parents saw every game he played," the coach recalled. "You talk about devoted parents. Their children were everything to them. Mr. Jordan, he was a quiet man. Mrs. Jordan, she was the dynamic personality in that relationship. Anybody who spent time around them had to be impressed by the strong will of Dolores Jordan. She was protective of her children. Some parents just dropped the kids off, not them, they were there, but they were not meddlesome or trying to influence my decisions. In fact, they never said a word to him about how he coached the team. The Wilmington All-Stars drove to Shelby, near Charlotte, for the state recreation tournament that spring of 1975. James Jordan was among a small group of parents who made the trip. Billingsley recalled that the team played in 4 games over 2 days, making it all the way to the tournament semifinals, where Wilmington lost to a team from Chapel Hill that had large, overpowering players in the front court. "The last night we were staying in our hotel," the coach recalled. "The kids were in their rooms playing. A few of the dads and the coaches dealt up some cards. It was nothing serious, just fun. Somebody said, 'Let's get some beer.'" Billingsley was impressed that James Jordan immediately pointed out that they were in a dry county, no alcohol. Mr. Jordan, he knew exactly where to go to get some beer. He drove over the state line and came back with 2 or 3 six-packs, Billingsley remembered. "We stayed up late, just having a good time, not really gambling. Mr. Jordan was a really good guy." It was the first of so many basketball trips that father and son would take over the coming years. Whoever they met had the same overwhelming opinion of James Jordan. "What a nice man," people would say time and again. "A person with hands-on friendliness, who had a smile and a pat on the back, generous with his affection, extending warmth even to a man like Bulls executive Jerry Krause, who would have more than his share of conflict with Michael. He was just such a friendly guy," Billingsley said. Most importantly, people saw something else. Michael Jordan had thoroughly and completely secured his father's affection. Clearly, on some level, Jordan himself had gained that knowledge. But on another level, the one that mattered most, such information never registered on the impenetrable core of a competitor's psyche. Michael Jordan's immutable agenda had been set, and on the slightest trigger, it could let loose a tide of passion that would stir others to wide-eyed wonder. No one, of course, would become more surprised by these moments than Jordan himself. As they came to him time and again over the years, that same blinking surprise was always there, and always the same question, too. What will I do next? The darkness. Despite appearances, the union of James and Dolores Jordan teetered on the brink of self-destruction in the mid-1970s. They projected an image of happiness, but their marriage was plagued by a discord that lurched at times into violent arguments. In the worst of these conflicts, beginning on Calico Bay Road, James and Dolores would go at each other in front of the children, who would run across the street hoping to find a grandparent to break up the melee. The move to Wilmington had done nothing to break this pattern. They didn't fight every day, but when they did, things got out of hand in a hurry. Daughter Sis recalled one set to where her mother went after her father, and he responded by knocking her out cold. The children feared she might be dead, but the next morning she appeared from the bedroom ready to face another day. Another incident brought a frightening car chase down a road near their house with the children in one of the cars. Such incidents fitfully interrupted a general peace that kept the family moving forward, but always with a lurking element of fear. James's job at General Electric allowed the family to live a comfortable life and provided opportunities for their children. All the kids were involved in activities outside of school, and the older ones even had part-time jobs. But even with James's salary, they faced financial pressures. Once Rosalind, the youngest child, entered school, Dolores took a job on the assembly line at the local Corning plant. It was shift work with a rotating schedule that threw the family routine into turmoil until one day Dolores finally could take no more and abruptly quit. She hadn't discussed it with James, but he took it in stride. Months later, she found work as a teller at a branch of United Carolina Bank. As if managing all of this wasn't enough, the couple decided to open a nightclub, Club Eleganza, which somehow seemed like a good idea at the time. They were both in their mid-30s and had spent a good portion of their teen years and all of their adult lives raising children. Neither of them ever mentioned the club in any of their later interviews with reporters about Michael's upbringing. It seems likely, however, that Club Eleganza played a role in their marital issues. Such ventures often drain time and money, and James and Dolores were already challenged by busy schedules with their children. Sis implied that the unhappy home life may have prompted Ronnie's shipping out for Army basic training just 2 days after he graduated from high school in 1975. Others suggested that he had dreamed of a life in the service for years, evidenced by his involvement in high school ROTC. Whatever the reason, Ronnie's departure added to the family's emotional strain. Dolores wept as the family saw him off at the bus station. It was like somebody in the house had died, Dolores said of Ronnie's departure. I couldn't go into his room for many, many years. He was the first to leave. Like many women facing the stresses and challenge of motherhood, she had also gained substantial weight. Although she would later lose the weight, the period proved to be a deeply emotional time for the mother of five. And, mindful of her own troubles as a teen, she had grown quite anxious over signs that daughter Sis was becoming sexually active. Never close, mother and daughter soon found themselves in what seemed like an almost daily series of ugly arguments. The two were engaged in just such a bout one summer morning in 1975, as Dolores was driving her daughter up to her job. The exchange grew especially heated as they pulled up to Sis's place of work, Gibson's Discount Store. Dolores supposedly called her daughter a slut. If I'm such a slut, why don't you keep your husband out of my bed, Sis retorted, as she would later detail in a book she independently published, In My Family's Shadow. Dolores's jaw dropped. She was staggered by the comment, but before she could gather her thoughts to reply, her daughter jumped out of the car and ran into work. Dolores responded by leaning on the car horn in an attempt to bring her daughter back outside. Inside the store, Sis tried to ignore the blaring horn, but finally the store manager told her to go back outside and see what her mother wanted. When Sis got back in the car, Dolores told her daughter to explain what she had just said. The mother listened silently as Sis told of a pattern of persistent abuse over 8 years, in which James Jordan would visit her late at night in the bed she shared with Rosalyn, who was a preschooler when the alleged abuse began. Sis recounted how her father first explained that he was teaching her to kiss like an adult, how confused she was, how the abuse escalated over time. What followed next was a harrowing scene, according to Sis's account. They drove to Club Eleganza, where James was doing some maintenance work. His wife ordered him into the car, and they drove to a little used road and pulled over, where Dolores told her daughter to repeat the allegations. As Sis delivered her account, Dolores told her husband that now certain things about the marriage made sense. James flew into a fury and began choking his daughter while screaming, Are you going to believe this tramp over me? Sis recalled being stunned at her father calling her a tramp. With Sis gasping, Dolores told him to stop or she would kill him. Finally, then, the angry moment broke, Sis recalled in her book. They all calmed down and rode home, where the daughter retreated immediately to her bedroom. After about an hour, her mother came and told her that the circumstances made it impossible for the three of them to live together. Because Sis still had 2 years of high school left, she would have to leave the family to live in a girls' home. She told her daughter that James had explained that he was only trying to help her, and that she had terribly misunderstood his affection. Under no circumstances, Dolores said, was Sis ever to mention her allegations to anyone else, inside or outside of the family. The daughter did not tell her mother that it was already too late. At age 12, she had confided to a cousin her same age. In turn, that cousin supposedly told her brother. But if word of the situation spread in the larger Jordan family, it was only in whispers. No one else, it seemed, was about to confront James Jordan, who was both admired and feared in the family. The Jordans never acted on their threat of sending their daughter to a home for girls. The parents somehow managed to absorb the incident and move forward, all the while keeping a cheerful, outward demeanor. James Jordan in particular would continue to earn praise and affection as the amiable father of a very special athlete. Evaluating Sis's allegations, once they became public decades later in 2001, would prove nearly impossible because they had never been reported to authorities or investigated by social services or police at the time. Dolores Jordan had apparently considered her daughter's claims and concluded that taking the matter to authorities would destroy the family and endanger the other children as well. Criminal charges against James would have likely resulted in the loss of his employment and the family's primary means of support. A decade after the disclosure to her mother, Sis contacted a Charlotte lawyer about the possibility of filing a lawsuit against her parents. She recalled in her book that the lawyer referred her to criminal authorities in Wilmington, who in turn told her that the statute of limitations had expired. Michael was 12 at the time and unaware of the situation. He didn't learn of his sister's claims for many years. Sis left the family in 1977 to marry and begin a family of her own, although her life would be marked by depression and questionable behavior, which would later be used by some in the family to discount her allegations. Advocates for the victims of sexual abuse assert that such traits are often the symptoms experienced afterward by victims. The allegations of abuse would prove to be an unarticulated seed of division in the family. twisting it in many difficult directions over time, no matter the efforts to push them beyond memory. Michael Jordan drew his competitive spirit from the same deep feelings of love and loyalty he felt toward his parents. His emotions regarding his family existed on a far deeper level than his public could ever fathom. For so many years, his upbringing would be seen as the perfect story, a public view aided by his mother's persistent message that her family was a normal middle-class unit. As with the story of her teen pregnancy, there was an attempt to cover up a reality that was far from normal. Her defenders would say that her decision that day in 1975 reflected what she thought best to protect her family. The real story may help explain why late in life, well into her 70s, Dolores continued to travel the world, speaking in dozens of countries about family issues. She was never forthcoming on the deepest conflicts that threatened her own family, yet she often talked about the thing she clearly knew best: survival. Chapter 5: The Diamond. In the midst of this family turmoil in 1975, Michael Jordan had an extraordinary year as a 12-year-old little leaguer. He was named the state's most valuable player while throwing two no-hitters in leading his team to a state championship. Later, in regional play in Georgia, Michael would show his hitting prowess by driving a ball out of the park in a key moment, a feat that kept his father smiling for years afterward. "He used to talk about the time my little league team was going for the World Series," Jordan would remember, "and we were playing in Georgia, and there was an offer that if anyone hit a homer, they'd get a free steak. I hadn't had a steak in quite a while, and my father said, 'If you hit a homer, I'll buy you another steak.' It was a big ball field, and in the fourth inning I hit that sucker over the center field fence with two on to tie the game 3-3. We lost it anyway 4-3, but I've never experienced anything in sports like hitting one out of the park." At the time, James Jordan began to entertain the thought that his son was headed toward the big leagues. William Henry Jordan, a cousin, saw it too. "Michael pitched in an all-star game against my son when he was 12 years old," he remembered. "You could only pitch 4 innings under the rules at that time. He struck out all 12 batters he faced, if I remember correctly. He was throwing so hard. He pitched for New Hanover, and my son played for Pender County. We were sure that day when we watched him that MJ would be a pro player." Jordan wasn't just a pitcher. When he was 12 years old, he was an outstanding little league player, recalled Dick Nayer, who later coached Jordan in Babe Ruth League. "He was lanky. He played shortstop too. He'd go over behind third base to dig out a grounder. He'd backhand the ball. You've seen Derek Jeter do this? He'd jump up in the air and throw it over to first. He was named Mr. Baseball in North Carolina." With the award, Jordan was given a scholarship for 2 weeks that summer to Mickey Owen Baseball Camp in Missouri. It was a huge honor. The family proudly displayed his Little League trophies for years. Michael hit a 265-foot home run in the elimination game in Georgia, James would tell visitors. From the very start in Little League, he loved it and excelled in it. However, young Michael plummeted almost as swiftly as he had peaked. Nayer had taken Jordan and 4 other 13-year-olds in the Babe Ruth League draft that spring. The Babe Ruth League included players 13 to 15 years old. "He was a superstar coming out of Little League, but I'd always tell parents of my 13-year-olds, 'Your son's probably not going to get to play much this year,'" Nayer recalled. There was another reason that young Michael didn't get to play at age 13. The diamond was larger in this league, with longer base paths and a greater distance from the mound to home plate. Jordan no longer had the arm to dominate. "When I got him, I couldn't play him at shortstop," Nayer recalled of Jordan's first year, 1976, in Babe Ruth League. "He couldn't make the throws. Mike didn't get into but about 4 games for me when he was 13. I don't think he got to bat but 4 times that season." If the Jordans were infuriated by the circumstances, they never allowed Nayer to see it. James Jordan even helped the coach build a baseball field during his time as a team parent. "Mike's dad and mom, they had no problem with it," the coach recalled in a 2012 interview. "They were good-natured people anyway. James was not an interfering dad with me for 3 years, not at all. He was nothing but helpful." The 13-year-old Jordan never complained either. Nayer said, "My experience with Mike for 3 years, he was a joy to coach, very cooperative. All the time I knew him, he just wanted to play." Bill Billingsley, who watched the team play, was struck that the 13-year-old Jordan often wound up standing on the sideline in a windbreaker, coaching first base. The opportunities were clearly limited for Jordan. Youth sports can be cruel like that, heaping glory on a young player at one stage of the game, then snatching it away at another. Because he wasn't playing much, Jordan turned to amusing himself and others. He was a loosey-goosey guy, Nayer said. He kept all the guys loose. Always a joker, the young Jordan stepped up the pace of his antics, putting shaving cream in his teammates' batting helmets, tapping people on the shoulder and hiding, or any other prank he could dream up. Jordan's old friend David Bridgers was on the team as well. He was Mike's number one fan, Nayer recalled. They called him the White Michael Jordan. He and Mike were the best of friends, but they'd get in a physical fight nearly every practice. They were both so competitive they'd pick on each other, and Bridgers was a good athlete. Nayer looked up one day at batting practice to find Bridgers on top of Jordan wailing away. Jordan, who had been catching, began talking trash as Bridgers whiffed on some pitches. He told Bridgers that if he tried swinging at the ball with his big ears, he might actually have a chance of getting a hit. Mike was lying on the ground with all his equipment on, and David was on top of him just pounding away on the mask, Nayer recalled. Like hockey players, they used to get into it all the time. Nayer separated the two. He recalled the tears rolling down Bridger's face. When the coach heard what had caused the brouhaha, he laughed and asked Jordan if he'd looked in a mirror lately. Jordan's own unusual ears had been the subject of Larry's taunts during their backyard battles. Nayer had nicknames for all his players, so he nicknamed Jordan Rabbit in honor of the jug handles on the side of his head, and the anger was apparently diffused. The kids liked that, the coach said. We were messing around with Mike. Mike's ears lay real close to his head, just like a rabbit. So we were all standing around one day trying to decide, why don't we call him Rabbit? Those ears lay real close. Everybody laughed. Mike was fine with it. When they were in Chicago, James told the reporters that Mike was nicknamed Rabbit because he was so fast. That didn't have nothing to do with it. Jordan did get into the lineup in a big game that first year. Two of the team's catchers couldn't play when Nayer's undefeated team was facing another undefeated club sponsored by Mutual of Omaha. Jordan talked the coach into letting him catch, despite the fact that his throws from behind the plate could only reach second base on the hop. Mike said, "Coach, I'll catch." He was so little and skinny, but he had huge hands, Nayer recalled. I said, "Come on, Rabbit, there ain't no way. You can't get the ball to second base. That's 128 feet down to that bag." He said, "Coach, I'll do it." That's the kind of kid he was. One of Nayer's assistant coaches suggested they teach Jordan how to skip-hop the ball accurately to second base on the bounce. The assistant coach told Jordan to throw the ball tight, just over the pitcher's head. Jordan picked up the technique right away. He delivered the ball low on the bounce, right where the second baseman could put a tag on a sliding runner. Nayer recalled warm-ups before the big game that day. We were taking infield, and the Mutual players were all standing by the fence watching. When they saw Jordan throw on the bounce, they started laughing. They went crazy and started razzing him. "Oh, look at that spaghetti arm. We're going to run on you tonight, Mr. Spaghetti Arm." Mike flipped up his catcher's mask and looked at them. He grinned and said, "You run, and I will gun." We all laughed. That was funny. In the second inning, they sent a man, and Mike threw him out. They sent three or four, Mike threw him out, and they quit running. We laughed about that. After the game, Mike said, "I told you I could do it." Many years later in Chicago, Jordan would confide to Bulls assistant coach Johnny Bach that the circumstances were difficult, that he felt a sense of isolation and pain as one of two black players on his youth baseball teams. In all of Nayer's 37 years of coaching, he had only three black players on his teams, including Jordan. "That'll give you a feeling for how it was," the coach said. "I got the NAACP on me because I didn't have any blacks on my team. Generally, you'd go out there and see a 12-man squad, and only one would be black. I told the NAACP that it was hard if you got 250 kids trying out for the league and there were only three black kids among them." For his first 2 years in the Babe Ruth League, Jordan had Terry Allen as his only black teammate. His last year in the league, his only black teammate was Clyde Simmons, who would go on to a career as an all-pro defensive end for the Philadelphia Eagles. If anything, perhaps the numbers emphasized the Jordan family's great pains to include their son in a game that was overwhelmingly white. When his teams traveled about the region playing games that required overnight stays, Jordan would be placed with local black families. The situation allowed him to meet people and make friends, but the circumstances were clearly awkward. The Jordans never expressed any negative feeling about the racial makeup of the teams. "There was never any resentment from Mike that I ever saw," Nayer said. The coach recalled the team practicing one evening on a field in a rough neighborhood. During the practice, two men went into the dugout and started rummaging through the team's cooler. Nayer asked the men to stop, and they responded with threats and curses. Someone from the team went to phone the police, and while the players waited, Jordan used the N-word in referring to the two men, Nayer recalled. The moment reflected the difficulty of the situation. Youth baseball, the largely white game, found itself in awkward circumstances, practicing on the only available fields in predominantly black neighborhoods in an era when racial animosity still ran high. It's only logical that an adolescent Jordan might have trouble negotiating identity issues in that context. That winter, over several days in late January 1977, ABC aired the award-winning miniseries Roots, author Alex Haley's saga about the African-American experience and the inhumanity of slavery. Jordan was transfixed and profoundly moved by the story. It was hundreds of years of pain that they put us through, and for the first time I saw it from watching Roots, he explained years later. I was very ignorant about it initially, but I really opened my eyes about my ancestors and the things that they had to deal with. He hadn't had any overwhelming personal experience with racism, he would explain later, but the knowledge of America's ugly past was so infuriating it occupied his mind. Everywhere he turned, there were things he hadn't noticed before, things that only raised more questions about racism and injustice and how it affected his own family. The Hunt Club. The boys from the whites-only Wallace Hunting Club would remember the face decades later, even those who had no idea he was the great-grandfather of a legend. Dawson Jordan, the Hunt Club cook, made that kind of impression. He was the old man with a crutch who walked with startling quickness, always teetering on the brink of disaster that never materialized, the master who somehow turned out sumptuous meals. And who could forget those biscuits? He wore overalls and an apron and always sported a gray stubble of beard on his deeply wrinkled face. But mostly it was the sadness in his tired, bloodshot eyes that struck them. The countenance suggested a hard life. It was a rough-looking face, remembered Mike Taylor, who came to the Hunt Club with his father each week. Dawson Jordan was indeed a colorful man and beloved for his crusty character as well as his food by the members of the Wallace Hunting Club. Ken Roberts, who also spent his boyhood there, was first struck by Dawson's kindness. One of the first times they met, Roberts asked how he should address the older gentleman. "He told me just to call him Dawson," Roberts recalled. The club was little more than a run-down barracks that sat on a vast parcel of rented land above the northeast Cape Fear River in Pender County. Later it would be torn down and replaced with another structure, and then abandoned altogether. "The clubhouse would be considered a ramshackle, filthy place by today's standards," explained Mike Taylor. "I remember a long, one-story clapboard structure, rather low-slung and hardly off the ground, in need of painting, with a porch that ran the length on the front. Inside were common sleeping areas filled with bunks and metal single beds, with a dining room featuring a long table. I think Dawson cooked on a wood stove. It was the kind of place where even the screen doors needed repair. That fact sticks out because one of the hunting dogs that always seemed to be lying about the yard went through the torn screen one Saturday and stole a hogshead from the kitchen that Dawson was planning on cooking and turning into one of his mysterious delights." The primary figure in the operation of the Hunt Club was Robert Carr, known as Mr. Robert to all those who dealt with him. He was a presence in Pender County, where he owned an oil distributorship and served as chairman of the North Carolina Game and Wildlife Commission. Carr could be overbearing, but he held a fierce affection for Dawson Jordan. Their relationship was just one of those paradoxes left over from an earlier time. "Mr. Dawson was real good to Mr. Robert, and Mr. Robert was real good to Mr. Dawson," explained Ken Roberts, adding that Carr's respect for Jordan set the tone for the rest of the members of the club. "Everybody respected Mr. Dawson. Didn't nobody mess with him because Robert Carr would have had their ass." Roberts recalled, "Mr. Robert would pick him up and carry him down to the Hunt Club every Wednesday. Even when it wasn't deer season, they'd go down each Wednesday. They just enjoyed getting away. The two men would ride out North Carolina Highway 50 to the club, where they'd prepare for the usual gathering, a good old boy fun fest of eating, drinking, telling tales, and even doing a little hunting and fishing every now and then." Jordan's legendary meals were highlights of the experience. The breakfast was traditional Southern fare with country ham, biscuits, gravy, eggs, grits, and other dishes full of salt, butter, and fatback for seasoning, Mike Taylor recalled. I'm sure the lunch was equally as delicious and unhealthy. There was coffee, but men also brought their own liquor, which was freely consumed as well. The boys at the Hunt Club, much like Dawson's own family, wondered at all the work he did while hobbling around the club's kitchen and dining room. I recall being concerned how he could possibly prepare that meal, clean the dishes, and do all that work, Taylor remembered. I think I asked my dad if he had any help, and he replied they pitched in to get the food to the table. It was served family style with big bowls and platters passed around the long table. Ken Roberts, who was about 10 at the time, also recalled being concerned about how much work the crippled old man had to do to cook for the gathering, so he made every attempt to help him with the chores, getting the jars of molasses on the table each morning and helping with the dishes. I'd get up in the morning, it would be cold as hell, Roberts remembered. Mr. Dawson would be lighting the stove. He was a quiet man, but he kind of took to me because I was one of the youngest down there. Roberts recalled one unforgettable day that brought the first cuss words I ever heard. Robert Carr was entertaining the other members of the State Game and Wildlife Commission at the Hunt Club. These were men of success and community standing from all across North Carolina, all seated at the long table waiting for Jordan to bring out one of his famous meals. Every meal was biscuits, Robert said. No matter what he was serving, there were biscuits. Jordan was coming out of the kitchen with a steaming plate of biscuits fresh from the oven when he suddenly stumbled and spilled them all across the club's well-trafficked hardwood floor. For a moment, the group sat in silence. Then Mr. Robert said, Dawson, put them biscuits on the table. This was a gathering of distinguished city guys, Roberts explained. Mr. Robert looked around the table and said, Those are Dawson's biscuits. Anybody who doesn't eat one is a son of a bitch. Those biscuits disappeared. They ate them all. When he wasn't cooking, Dawson Jordan retreated to an adjacent small building, what appeared to be a former tobacco pack house, where he slept. Roberts, who would sometimes visit with him there, said, I can remember in that little room he had an old-style feather bed. There was a small oil lamp and a little stove. He was always sitting on his bed reading. He didn't socialize with those folks at the Hunt Club a lot. He was just a nice fellow, but he probably wasn't too keen on spending a lot of time with the white people there. That late winter of 1977, 3 short weeks after Michael had watched the TV series Roots, his great-grandfather died in Teachy, just months short of his 86th birthday. From resting in his sweet mother's arms as a baby in Holly Shelter, to rafting logs on the Great River, to struggling behind the plow and moving silently on a still Carolina night to deliver moonshine, to feeding the hungry folks at the Wallace Hunting Club, Dawson Jordan had survived much. In the process, he'd managed to build a family that would somehow find a way to endure the harshest blows that the dark recesses of human behavior could deliver, even in the context of great wealth and fame. His grandchildren and great-grandchildren would long treasure their time spent in his commanding presence, and Dawson Jordan had affected the people at the Wallace Hunting Club as well. Ken Roberts recalled his family being struck in 1977 by the news of Dawson's passing. I remember my granddaddy telling me that Dawson had died, he said. It was a big thing to him. The Jordan family wept freely that day. His great-grandfather had been well aware of Michael's exploits on the baseball field, but his fame in basketball had yet to unfold. That, in itself, would prove a thing of wonder for the members of the Hunt Club and the people of Pender County. I remember when MJ made it big, Ken Roberts said with a laugh. My father-in-law said, Old Dawson would have loved to see that. The deep sadness the whole family felt at Dawson's passing perhaps reinforced Michael's newly discovered racial anger. He didn't know every detail of his grandfather's life, but he had only to look at the pain deep in the old man's face to get an idea of how troubled his restless journey had been, and of the many senseless barriers he had been forced to endure. Later that year, a girl at school called Michael a nigger. I threw a soda at her, he recalled. It was a very tough year. I was really rebelling. I considered myself a racist at that time. Basically, I was against all white people. Jordan was suspended for the incident, but rather than let him spend his days at home, his mother required that he sit in her car in the parking lot of the bank where she worked, so that she could keep an eye on him from the teller's window. That way she could make sure he was doing his schoolwork and staying out of trouble. Michael was furious, and years later he would joke with her that the situation presented an obvious case of child abuse. Yet Dolores got her message across. Over the course of the following months, she talked time and again about the wasted energy of bitterness and racial anger, how destructive they could be to a young boy. It wasn't about forgetting, but about forgiving, she said. It would take more than a year for the message to sink in and the feelings to subside. The education came from my parents, Jordan recalled. You have to be able to say, okay, that happened back then. Now let's take it from here and see what happens. It would be very easy to hate people for the rest of your life, and some people have done that. You've got to deal with what's happening now and try to make things better. In shaping her son's attitude, Dolores Jordan was drawing on her own experience coming of age on the coastal plain. But it was much more than that. She was so focused on the future, on the positive, on achieving, that she would let neither infuriating social injustice nor her daughter's heartbreaking allegations of abuse stand in the way. She had no time for a single issue, no matter how grave, that didn't involve betterment. Stopping for anything meant certain defeat to Dolores Jordan. Having tasted such disappointment early in her own life, she was not about to be defeated again. Here it comes. In March 1977, Jordan watched the University of North Carolina's twisting run through the NCAA basketball tournament on TV, but wouldn't allow himself to be impressed. He would admit later that, as an NC State fan, he absolutely despised the Tar Heels. Still, it was a spellbinding moment for college basketball fans as network television discovered the potent chemistry of what would come to be known as March Madness. The attention certainly had something to do with the fact that the dunk returned to college ball that season after being outlawed for 9 years, dating back to the Lou Alcindor era at UCLA. There was likely another instinctive reason young Michael disliked the Tar Heels. Just as dunking was set to electrify crowds again, Dean Smith and North Carolina made the Four Corners slowdown offense famous, or infamous. That tournament had the state of North Carolina smeared all over it, thicker than barbecue sauce. Upstart UNC Charlotte, led by Cedric Cornbread Maxwell, upset Michigan in the Mideast Regionals, putting two teams from the same state in the Final Four. North Carolina eventually met Marquette for the national championship. The Tar Heels were led by point guard Phil Ford, who competed despite an injured elbow, but he couldn't shoot and was no help against Marquette's zone. Dean Smith was denied a championship yet again, having made it to the Final Four 5 times without winning the title. Jordan gleefully watched the game on TV with his family. My mom liked Phil Ford, but I couldn't stand him or any of them Carolina guys, he recalled. I rooted for Marquette in the 77 championship game. My mom got mad. That spring and summer, a 14-year-old Jordan started every game for Dick Nair's Babe Ruth baseball team. But the magic he had known as a 12-year-old never returned. I couldn't play him at shortstop, Nair recalled. He couldn't make the throws. Occasionally, I'd put him at third base. I played him at first base. I'd play him left field. He would pitch. When he was 14, he was in the rotation to pitch. He'd pitch every couple or 3 games. However, his pitching was no longer dominant, and at the plate, his bat speed wasn't quite there. He hit 270, 275 that year, Nair said. That was the highest he ever had for me. Usually in a youth league, you'd see kids hit 380, 400, that kind of stuff. Mike could hit. He was dependable. He'd be probably one of your better 230 hitters. He was an integral part of what we did, but he was never the star in Babe Ruth that he was at Little League. He played for me for 3 years, and he never made an all-star team. In the fall of 1977, Jordan entered D.C. Virgo Middle School, where he quickly became an early morning fixture in the gymnasium. Staff member Dave Allen would open up the facility each day and soon noticed Jordan's leaping ability and his tongue sticking out as he went to the basket. "Son, I'm afraid that you're going to bite it off," Allen told him. Sure enough, about a week later, a bloodied Jordan appeared in the principal's office. Allen asked if it was the tongue. Jordan could only nod. One of his partners in these preseason sessions was Harvest Leroy Smith. At almost 6'7", it was his height against Jordan's quickness in their one-on-one battles. He and I practiced every day together, and he always had to win. If it was a game of horse and you beat him, you would have to play another game until he won, Smith recalled. You didn't go home until he had won. Jordan, then just over 5'7", found many ways to get to the basket. You'd see him get a shot off, and you'd wonder how he did it because he wasn't that big, Smith said. But it was the quickness. The only question was how big he was going to be and how far up he would take his skill level. Jordan answered that with an eye-opening ninth-grade basketball season for a team coached by Fred Lynch. Jordan soon piqued the interest of varsity coaches around the area. "I watched him at Virgo right after he made his debut," remembered Dick Nayer, whose son Steve played basketball with Jordan. Their team went down to Burgaw to play a junior high team. Mike dropped 44 points, and they didn't play but six-minute quarters in junior high. "Jordan scored 44 of his team's 54 points that game," Nayer recalled. "He got to where he started hitting shots, then he started going to the bucket." Jim Hebron, the varsity coach at nearby New Hanover High School, began watching Jordan closely. "I remember Jim Hebron told me when he was a ninth grader that he was going to be something special," recalled Marshall Hamilton, then the coach at nearby Southern Wayne High School. The buzz wasn't loud, but without a doubt, it began there in ninth grade at D.C. Virgo. Jordan emerged at a time before basketball exploded in popularity. AAU competition would soon blanket the sport with an elaborate process that commodified young talent. "Now kids 12 and under playing AAU basketball think they've made it," Tom Konchowski, a veteran basketball scout, observed in a 2011 interview. In 1977-78, Jordan had only the short basketball schedule of the public school league to develop. The AAU competition that came later gave young players many hours of game experience. But the grind and the coddling of that talent machine likely would have robbed Jordan of his essence, Konchowski added. "I don't think he would have had this all-consuming competitiveness. The thing that really set him apart is he had tremendous competitiveness, that XYY chromosome in terms of competitiveness. That's maybe been his downfall in other areas of his life, but in basketball, that defined him. That transcended his athleticism. He wouldn't have had that, because what happens with AAU is there's always another game. You will play three games in a day. You can lose a game in disgrace, and 2 hours later, there's always the next game. So you're not as focused on winning. Winning's not a critical obsession, and that's what set Michael Jordan apart from other players, that he was an obsessively competitive player. Had he grown up in an AAU culture, he would have lost his winning edge, he would have lost what his real thing is, and that's his competitiveness." As fate would have it, Bill Billingsley, who had coached Jordan on the 12-year-old All-Star basketball team, was hired that spring as a substitute teacher at D.C. Virgo and was assigned to coach the ninth-grade baseball team. He was well aware of Jordan's frustration with the game. "He was losing interest," Billingsley said of Jordan's relationship with baseball. "His body was changing, growing, and he had already had some success in basketball." In fact, many of the best memories of Billingsley's ninth-grade baseball team at D.C. Virgo School involved basketball. Bud Blanton, a white kid, and Jordan were clearly the two best athletes on the baseball team. Billingsley would find them each afternoon engaged in heated battles of one-on-one in the school gym. "They'd go in there and they'd play basketball, and you'd think it was World War III," the coach remembered with a laugh. "They would really go at it." One day, Jordan even coaxed Billingsley, who was in his 20s, into a game. "He wasn't as hard on me as when he played Blanton," the coach explained. "He'd stand all the way out at the top of the key and say, 'Hey, coach, you gonna let me have this?'" Billingsley had sagged back into the lane to protect against Jordan's quickness to the hoop, only to watch him drain three-point shots from outside in those days before the three-pointer was legal. "He's adding a little range," the coach thought. The young Jordan was already spicing such moments with a taste of trash talk, Billingsley said. When he was 14, he wasn't exactly modest. He was a chatterbox. He loved the verbal gamesmanship. Some didn't take so well to the commentary. "He did have a scrap with one of the boys. Michael whacked him around a bit," Billingsley said. "I think he got in some trouble for it and was taken to the principal's office. Michael was a very respectful, well-behaved kid, but he wasn't shy about defending his interests." Jordan did some pitching for Virgo that season, but mostly he caught. Bud Blanton was already displaying the talent that would earn him a scholarship to pitch in the Southeastern Conference at the University of Kentucky. Jordan's act behind the plate mixed a little Mick Jagger with some Richard Pryor. "He'd catch the ball and laugh and dance out from behind the plate. The whole place would be rocking," Billingsley said of Virgo's home games. Blanton, the son of a local deputy who had passed away, was blessed with a mix of good stuff, speed, as well as a doozy of a knuckleball, which gave Jordan a lot to work with. There was one game in particular against nearby Jacksonville, Billingsley remembered. Blanton could throw hard, then change to that knuckleball. The hitters were baffled and seemed a little scared. What really baffled them was the guy behind the plate. "You can't hit this ball," Michael would be telling them. Blanton would be winding up to deliver, and Jordan was there telling them, "Here it comes, here it comes." Billingsley sat behind the backstop, chuckling. "I can see it and hear it. With a knuckleball, those guys wouldn't even swing. The hitters were so confused, and Jordan was back there just basting them. Instead of looking at the pitch, they were peeking back at Jordan. I was laughing so hard I almost fell out of the chair." Every time Bud Blanton threw, Jordan would be telling them, "Look out now, here it comes." That summer, Jordan played his final season of Bayreuth ball. At 15, he was supposed to be one of my main pitchers, Dick Nair said. That didn't happen. I was able to put him in the outfield and a little at first base. Jordan didn't hit as well as the previous year either, but he was still effective. We played small ball, a lot of bunting, hitting, and running, Nair explained. Mike loved that. He could run. He didn't run fast. He just had a long stride, which was just enough to help his team win a championship. The telling moment came in a makeup game that went into extra innings scoreless. Mike walked, and he stole second, Nair said. I think we bunted him to third. So I put on a suicide squeeze. We had a 13-year-old who could really bunt. I put him in the lineup and told him to bunt and to protect Mike on third. But Mike was already halfway down the line when the pitcher let it go. Nair looked at the plate, and the batter had stepped out of the batter's box. His team looked to be headed for disaster, the coach recalled. There was the catcher with the ball sitting there looking at Mike about 40 feet away. So he jumped up, and the third baseman was standing beside the bag with his legs crossed, chewing his fingernails. Mike just turned around and faked like he was going back to third, and the catcher threw the ball into left field, so Mike came charging on down the line with the catcher sitting 3 feet in front of home plate. Mike hurdled him and landed on the plate, jumped completely over him. Everybody was like, "Wow, did you see that? We won the ball game 1-0 on Mike's play." But Nair emphasized it wasn't just that he had the athleticism to make the play, he also knew the rules. There was a rule that if you make contact and the catcher didn't have the ball, they could throw you out. So Mike avoided the contact. He jumped clean over the catcher. That next fall, Jordan went out for the junior varsity football team at Laney High School. He was already taller than the rest of the men in his family, nearing 5'9". But his mother tried to talk him out of it, pointing out his skinny arms and legs. He pleaded, she finally relented, and he found a spot in the defensive backfield, where he was soon leading the team in interceptions. Well into the schedule, Laney faced Brunswick County, a team that featured a big bruising running back who broke through the line early in the contest. Skinny Mike Jordan gamely stepped in to fill the gap. Suddenly, he was on the ground, writhing in pain and complaining about his shoulder. "It's broke, Coach, it's broke," he yelled as Coach Fred Lynch walked out to see what was wrong. Lynch, quite used to Jordan's constant joking around, told him, "Get up, you're holding up the game." Then he realized it was no joke. Dolores Jordan had arrived late and was just taking her seat when she saw that the action had stopped. A friend informed her that Michael was injured and that they were bringing an ambulance around to take him to the hospital. She recalled that her first instinct was to run down to see if he was all right, but she remembered that she had made a promise not to embarrass him. So she went back to her car and drove to the hospital to wait for him there. The shoulder was separated, but by the time the team had its banquet several weeks later, it had mended. Before the banquet, Michael and Bud Blanton threw around a football for a time, then went to the backyard basketball goal for some one-on-one. After that, Jordan took a running start and tried to dunk. He couldn't get it down, but it was close enough to encourage him to try again. Then again, and again, and again. Sweating and frowning, he spent much of the next hour taking the ball to the rim, tongue out. Finally, after about 30 tries, he got it over the cup and flushed. His smile said everything. He was excited, Blanton remembered years later. He was glad he had done it, but it was only a matter of time. Part 3. Emergence. Chapter 6. The Cut. The 15-year-old boy who pinned his hopes on trying out for the Laney High School varsity basketball team in the fall of 1978 was a far cry from the supremely confident Michael Jordan the world would come to know. That young man was stalked by self-doubt. He wasn't a bad student, mostly B's and C's, but there was no indication that he was headed for stardom in academics. And he hated working, making no effort to do anything to earn extra money. He was oblivious to the example of his brother Ronnie's two jobs during high school, and it was clear to his father that Michael would do anything to avoid anything that resembled effort. "That's the laziest boy I've ever seen," James Jordan would say time and again. If he had to get a job in a factory punching a clock, He'd starve to death. He would give every last dime of his allowance to his brothers and sisters, and even kids in the neighborhood to do his chores. He was always broke. Yet that laziness magically disintegrated when it came to sports. If it involved a ball in the air, a contest to be settled, the switch came on. In his adolescent mind, Michael figured maybe he could be a professional athlete. That was really about the only thing that interested him, which made him no different from millions of other daydreaming boys his age. He couldn't see how to make that happen, but rarely is there a clear or even a sane path to a life in professional sports. Time had narrowed his options. He had watched his advantages in baseball mostly disappear, and his mother was determined that he drop football entirely. His choices seemed so bleak that Dolores even suggested he begin taking home economics courses so that he could learn to sew and cook for himself. Chipping away at his self-esteem, she implied it might be wise to do so because he didn't seem to be the kind of guy who could easily attract a mate. It was her way of saying, just go on in the house with the women. Rather than getting bent out of shape, Jordan took her suggestion and signed up for the courses, and found he liked them. I remember he baked a cake in school that was so good we couldn't believe it, his mother said. We had to call his teacher to verify it. Nonetheless, at age 15, Jordan was verging on the melancholy common to so many teens. Truth be known, he didn't have a lot of friends. The single beacon, the one bright spot in his life, was basketball. After that ninth grade year at Virgo, Jordan and his lanky friend Leroy Smith attended a basketball camp run by Pop Herring, Laney High School's varsity coach. The school was just 3 years old, with a shiny new gym. Laney was a symbol of Wilmington's hard-won victories in integration, with a student population that was about 40% black. The city still ached racially, in so many ways reflecting the Wilmington that had been rocked by the 1898 riot when blacks were ushered to the railroad station and told to leave. For a lot of African Americans, the only way to get ahead still was to get out, offered Bill Billingsley, who would go on to earn a Ph.D. in history and write about the city's racial struggles. Laney High School, though, enjoyed relative tranquility during Jordan's years there, due in part to black and white students joining forces on the playing fields. Beyond the important gains brought by integrated classrooms, athletic competition became the primary place where the races learned to coexist, on a footing of newly developed mutual respect. But only in retrospect would such things be important. In 1978, Jordan was just another kid trying to make the varsity. Jordan clearly had been the best player on the ninth grade team, and was just as impressive at Herring's camp that summer. Afterward, he began visualizing the kinds of things he would do on the floor that winter for the Laney Buccaneers. He was pretty confident that he would make the varsity for the upcoming season. After all, even Leroy Smith and his other ninth grade teammates readily agreed that Jordan was the team's best player. This, of course, is the moment at which the Jordan mythology intersects with the tragedy that became Coach Pop Herring's life, resulting in a misunderstanding that would multiply fitfully over the ensuing decades. The story has been told in an endless wash of magazine pieces, newspaper stories, TV segments, videos, and radio broadcasts, just about every way that someone could recount how superstar Michael Jordan had been cut from his high school team. Buried under the avalanche of mythmaking was his coach, Pop Herring. He was a proud son of Wilmington who had attended New Hanover High School, where he played for a legend, Coach Leon Brogdon, who guided 8 different teams to state championships. Herring had played for Brogdon's final team to win a title, and then went off to play quarterback at North Carolina Central, where John McClendon had set up the coaching program in the 1930s. Herring probably could have played basketball, but in college he turned to football as the ticket to a degree. He returned to Wilmington afterward and went to work for a time as Brogdon's assistant. When Laney High opened in the mid-70s, Herring had the pedigree to be named the basketball coach. It was significant that he was an African-American head coach, which was rare at the time. Herring was a smart and personable young educator with a bright future when Michael Jordan came into the Laney High School program in 1978. In fact, Herring lived near the Jordans and was soon in the habit of stopping by in the mornings to pick up Michael to take him to the school gym for early workouts. He went the extra mile for his players, to the point of helping them write letters to colleges about the possibility of playing after high school. As his handling of Jordan would later prove, winning wasn't the most important thing in Pop Herring's world. His players were. Dick Nayer, who made a practice of closely observing coaches, had a son on Herring's team. He was a great guy, Nayer recalled. He had a mental breakdown. He was funny. He was good to the kids. He was a good coach. He was personable. But he really bottomed out. Sadly, within 3 years of Jordan's graduation from Laney, Herring's struggle with schizophrenia would end his career. When the mental disease surfaced, it brought about a sudden and swift disintegration of his personality. The once thoughtful, energetic young coach could be seen walking the city streets, transformed almost overnight into a disheveled zombie in pursuit of unseen demons, often talking to himself or to no one in particular. This proved terribly distressing to old friends. How could this happen? They asked time and again. How could this bright, special human being be reduced to this? Medication helped ease his condition somewhat, but his life descended into an increasingly familiar pattern of vicious mood and behavior swings, all accompanied by a plunging social status. His coaching friends tried to protect him the best they could, but even as his life came apart, the Jordan narrative was gaining a momentum of its own. In time, it would produce a storm of interest in one of the strangest mysteries in Jordan's background. He was cut from his high school team? The logical question followed. What dummy did that? The community in Wilmington over the years held tightly to the hard truth of Herring's situation, coming to grips with it, even as the media returned to the story time and again in their accounts of Jordan. The first reporter to make a major breakthrough on the truth was Kevin Sherrington from Dallas. Much later, Sports Illustrated would delve into the situation with a beautifully written piece about Herring. These and other stories came to imply that Jordan's claim itself had the trappings of a false narrative, that it was somehow a creation of the superstar's intensely competitive nature. But that doesn't seem to be the exact truth either, although the perception, shaped by the Sports Illustrated story, came to be another talking point of Jordan's mythology. The basic facts of the story stand out amidst all of the misunderstanding and well-intentioned revisionism. It's the age-old truth of public school competition. Young athletes try out for a team. Some make it, some don't. After years of answering questions about the Jordan story, the coaches began to imply that there weren't really any serious tryouts that fall for the Laney varsity. That revision, of course, opens up its own questions. If there were no tryouts, then they certainly would not have posted a list with the names of the players who made the varsity. But late that fall, Herring posted the list, in alphabetical order, of those who had been selected. Jordan had anticipated the news for days and hours and then seconds, and when it was posted, he was there almost immediately to read it. Then to reread it. Certainly there must be a mistake, he first thought. Even a 15-year-old Jordan knew that he was the best player on the ninth grade team, and it wasn't even close. But the only sophomore on the list was his long, tall friend, Leroy Smith. The realization of his defeat fell on him like a boulder that day. He walked home alone, avoiding anyone along the way. I went to my room and I closed the door and I cried, Jordan later recalled. For a while, I couldn't stop. Even though there was no one else home at the time, I kept the door shut. It was important to me that no one hear me or see me. The extenuating circumstance for Herring was the mix of his veteran team that fall. 11 seniors and 3 juniors were returning to the varsity. 8 of them were guards. Leroy Smith gave the team much-needed size, although he played sparingly. Given time to absorb the decision, Jordan came to an inescapable conclusion. Size mattered. I was pissed, he would tell writer John Edgar Wideman in 1990. Because my best friend, he was about 6'6", he made the team. He wasn't good, but he was 6'6", and that's tall in high school. He made the team, and I felt I was better. Years later, Smith himself would emphasize his own surprise at his selection, because it certainly wasn't based on talent. The debate, recalled Ron Coley, Herring's assistant coach, was what do we do with Leroy Smith? Coley, who later became a head coach in Pender County, claimed that he didn't even remember Jordan trying out, but he also described the young Jordan as a shy ball player. The coaches admitted later that the situation could have been handled better. Herring may well have talked to the sophomore about his future, but if he did, Jordan didn't comprehend it, and no one else recalled it. More likely, nothing was said because the situation was common and involved a long-valued principle of public school athletics. Coaches coached and made their decisions. There was not a lot of discussion involved in the process. The searing element was the list itself, which apparently remained posted for much of that season. It was there for a long, long time without my name on it, Jordan recalled.